This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So how does what you eat affect your mental health? Can food make you feel depressed? You know, when you eat too much junk food, you don't always feel great afterwards. You might feel a little bit sluggish and full, and then strangely, you're always hungry about an hour later. Well, there might be more to that than we realise. We know and we're learning more and more that ultra-processed food in extreme levels is bad for us. Foods like packaged snacks, fizzy drinks, sugary cereals, all that type of food that undergoes multiple processes, contains colours and emulsifiers and flavours and all sorts of additives. They're high in sugar, they're high in salt, and they're low in vitamins and fibre. So we know that these foods can lead to poor health outcomes, things like diabetes and heart disease. But more and more research is being done into how they impact our mental health, our mood, even our happiness levels. So does eating ultra-processed food, can it actually make you feel depressed? And could diet alone help treat depression? Whether you're feeling tired or bloated, you're just feeling a little bit unhappy, how much of that has got to do with your diet? How does what you eat affect your mood? And how connected is our gut and our brain?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, my name's Rochelle Hunt and today we are live from our Geelong pop-up. We are on the waterfront, we're a part of Deakin University and can I just say Geelong is putting it on today. It looks absolutely spectacular. Hello to the people out the front, lovely to see you this morning. If you're in the area, pop on down, you can't miss us. We are right out the front of the pier, the Cunningham Street Pier. The water looks absolutely beautiful. So if you're in the Geelong area or if you've got nothing planned this afternoon, we're here all afternoon. Trevor will be here as well. So you can drive on down or pop on the train and come down and join us at our Geelong pop-up. Today we're talking about food and mood. How connected is our gut and our brain? Professor Felice Jacka is with you. She's the director of the Food and Mood Centre. Dr. Melissa Lane, who is a postdoctoral research fellow in nutritional psychiatry, also at the Food and Mood Centre, is with you, alongside Dr. Wolfgang Marx, a senior research fellow, and Dr. Jessica Green, who's a psychiatrist and a PhD student here at Deakin. A warm welcome to all of you. Felice, let's start with you. When we talk about food and mood, we all kind of know, right, whether we have done studies on it or not, there are certain foods that make us feel blah after we eat them. We feel sluggish, we don't feel like doing anything, we might even feel like having a sleep. And then after a while, you might get your energy levels back or you might, you know, sort of just feel generally a little bit better. But there's more to it than that. When we talk about the connection between food and mood, how much research is going into that?
Well, there's actually been a fair amount now over the last decade or so. And so some of the things you referred to there are really around that short-term impact of a meal on your mental health or your cognitive capacity. But nutritional psychiatry as a field looks more at the long-term impacts. It looks at how what we might eat as a general rule, our habitual diets and our nutritional status influence mental and brain health. And we look at this right across the life course. And the work that we've done in the field has shown that right across the world and right across the lifespan, from what mums eat during pregnancy right up to what we eat in the later stages of our life, affect the risk for emotional behavioural problems in children, affect the risk for depression, anxiety, right across the life course. And this is independent, really importantly, of things like education, income. Importantly, it's not explained by body weight, so this is quite independent of body weight. And then what we also know is that if you have people with even quite severe clinical depression and you support them to improve their diet quality, to reduce the intake of those ultra-processed foods and other discretionary foods, increase the intake of healthful foods, so plant foods and extra virgin olive oil, etc., that you can have a very profound impact on even quite severe illness within a short space of time. So there's been several studies that have looked at that. What we're increasingly wanting to understand is how this is working. We know that diet affects our immune system, it affects the way our genes express themselves, it affects our brain plasticity, this key part of the brain called the hippocampus. It affects our mitochondrial function, our neurotransmitter systems, our stress response system, and all of those in turn influence our mental and brain health. So figuring out what's going on there is a really key focus for us, and a big part of that now is our microbiome. This is the microbes, the many trillions of microbes that live in us and on us and that we've co-evolved with, and they're involved in virtually every process in our body. And certainly with the gut microbiota, they're very profoundly influenced by what we eat. And they affect all of those other systems I just talked about, particularly our immune system.
Is this something where we are leading, and in particular in Australia and Deakin, where we are leading this type of research? Or is this a kind of a bit of a global shift where we're starting to really consider literally what we put in our mouths and how that impacts our mental and our mood, like how it affects our mental health?
Well, I think excitingly for a lot of people, particularly people who live in the Geelong area, is we are unique in the world and we are the world leaders. We really established this field. We've led the seminal studies, so from very early life through adolescent health, through adult health to the end of life, the first clinical trial we led, the very well-known SMILES trial. And the work that we've done is now been very widely cited in more than 100 high-level policy documents around the world, the World Health Organization, their World Mental Health Report, list for the first time unhealthy diet as a risk factor for mental disorders. And in Australia, for the first time anywhere in the world, the peak body for psychiatrists, the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, has put what is essentially lifestyle medicine as the foundation of treatment. They call it foundational. They call it essentially non-negotiable. So this is achieving a healthy diet, exercise,
sleep. See, this is
sleep.
Interesting though, right? Because then we need to get into things like socioeconomics and the fact that it is cheaper to buy junk food than it is fresh food. And then you've got new suburbs that are opening up where you have junk food outlets on every corner that are put in place before the houses are built and before greengrocers are even established. So when we start to have this conversation, you start to talk about everything from politics to where we build.
And food systems. And this is a really key fact. This should not be up to the individual. This is not about ascribing blame to individuals about their dietary choices.
No.
It's about what are the economic levers, what's the food systems, what's the food policy. That is the key question.
Dr. Felice Jacka is with you. So, Professor Felice Jacka, Director of the Food and Mood Centre. Already plenty of texts on this. This is from Sue. I feel like I've been waiting 20 years to hear this conversation. Thank you. 20 years ago, I ditched all colours, flavours and preservatives. My migraines reduced to once a month, which was generally mainly menstrual. The depressive slumps eased too and my productivity seemed to increase. And others saying I've reduced my sugar in my diet over the past week in an effort to try and ease perimenopause symptoms, especially anxiety. I've noticed now that I'm feeling depressed and I actually really miss chocolate. I didn't realise how much I was regulating my mood with our sugary treats. That's from Bronte in Seaford. Dr. Melissa Lane and Dr. Wolfgang Marx, when we talk about processed food and how it might actually ultra processed food. So let's be specific here. So those types of foods that are really high in sugar, when you turn them over on the back, the first four or five ingredients probably aren't even food. They're just a series of numbers and gels and all sorts of things that we don't even know what they are. How much does that impact our mental health?
Well, we know that we've just recently published a study in the British Medical Journal, largest study of its kind, and it was a review of meta-analyses. So these are studies that pull together lots of individual studies. And what we found is that a higher intake of these ultra-processed foods were associated with a higher risk for common mental disorder outcomes, particularly depression and anxiety. So we know that these types of products do, you know, they are associated with poorer mental health outcomes.
How frustrated does that make you feel when you hear that? We know that right now. It's been published in the British Medical Journal, one of the most well-respected global journals, and yet we're still selling it and marketing it as breakfast food. for children and for families. And even just recently we had the head of Kellogg's even promoting that cereal was a good dinner option as well.
Yeah, so I think this whole concept of ultra-processed foods is really quite a novel addition to the our understanding of some of these foods that what's good for us. So previously we've had this really intense focus on the nutrients that are included in these foods. So we kind of generally understand that foods that are high in salt, high in sugar, high in fat are probably not going to be good for our physical health, perhaps our mental health. But what our research really brings is that it's not just about the nutrients, it's likely all these other factors that go into how those foods are actually created. So it's the industrial processing, the hydrogenation, all these things that you're not really going to find in your home kitchen, the addition of colorants, the additives, all these sorts of things is really what is this new sort of field, this new dimension to our understanding of what's good and what's bad for us.
Angela, she's called from Geelong, where we are here today. Morning, Angela.
Oh, hi. Look, I was just wondering whether there's been any studies done yet on pregnancy, the relationship of this gut health and diet on pregnancy and the fetus and the brain development of the fetus.
Really good question, Angela. We'll come back to ultra-processed foods in just a tick, but Felice, there has been an incredible amount of work and research done in this area here at Deakin.
Well, what we've seen is these are association studies in humans, so we know that the quality of women's diets during pregnancy and the quality of children's diets in those first few years is linked to their emotional behavioural outcomes, so, you know, depression, anxiety symptoms in children, but also linked to ADHD. What we don't know exactly is how this is working. We think that the gut is really important, but most of that research so far has really just happened in animal studies. We're leading a really important study in humans where we're targeting pregnancy, helping women to eat a more healthy diet.
And again, right, we don't want to guilt and shame women here because, let's face facts, when you are pregnant, hand on heart, all I could eat was cheese on toast and ginger beer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So
ice
that's
cream,
not a good diet.
Potato cakes. So.
Yeah, it's the only thing that's going to be spewing every morning.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you manage what you can actually...
It's a really, really good question. And we don't have the answers to that yet. I think that's the next steps is how do we support women to make healthier choices during their pregnancy. But what we do know, and we've published this, is that when women understand about the gut, about the importance of their own gut microbiota, their infant's gut microbiota to brain development and as well as immune development, it really does prompt them to make healthier choices. And so that's what we're building on for our new Bugs and Bumps study.
Wolfgang?
Yeah, and I think sort of to build on that, I think one of our sort of key focuses on all of our research is it's less about the individual, it's more about what can we do to address the food system, our policies around and our education. It's this multifaceted sort of layer. So how can we improve the diet quality and our food system at a
population? So what do you mean by food system, though? Do you mean where we grow produce, how accessible it is, the cost of it, all of the above?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I guess when you're saying... we're not blaming anyone. It's very hard to say, well, just eat better if you're in an area where there's, you know, fast food on every single corner and all these sorts of things where the deck is stacked against
you. Because people are a little bit upset at me saying it's not true that, you know, junk food is not cheaper, that fresh fruit and veg is cheaper. So technically, yes, that's the case, but it's about accessibility, right? So if you can't access free fruit and veg, if you have to get in the car to drive to get free cheap fruit and veg, then that's vastly different.
So what we did during our SMILES trial, which was the first randomised controlled trial of with people with major depressive disorder to help them to improve their diet, we did a very, very detailed cost analysis of the diet we were recommending versus the sort of junk food heavy diet that people were eating when they came into the study. We actually found that our diet was cheaper. Our healthier diet was cheaper, and this is because we're not recommending that people go out and buy organic this and fresh fish and fresh berries. We were saying, and we continue to say, that the best choices that you can make for your dollar as well as your health are things like frozen vegetables, tinned and dried beans, so chickpeas, lentils, these sorts of things that are super cheap. Tinned fish is great. Foods like these that you can have in the freezer... they are really easy to turn into very, very simple meals, and they're inexpensive.
And then comes in the whole role of education as well. There's lots of texts on that. Don't even get me started on school canteens. We might get into that in just a moment. You're on The Conversation Hour. My name's Rochelle Hunt. Today we are down at Geelong. We are at our pop-up studio. If you're in the area, we're on the waterfront. We are talking food and mood and the connection there. We have got Professor Felice Jacka, Dr. Melissa Lane, Dr. Wolfgang Marx, and we also have Dr. Jessica Green, all with Deakin University, who specialise in how what we eat impacts our mental health.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you. Our number's 1300 222 774. Jess, the term gut health, I feel like it's something that's kind of relatively new. I'm talking like over the last decade or so, where you might see products that are kind of pitched to us and pushed to us to help with our gut health and that understanding of it, our gut being our second brain. When we talk about gut health, that's pretty broad, yeah? What does it mean?
Very good question, and I don't know that I'm exactly able to answer that question. I think that's a term that's sort of marketed a lot with a lot of different...
So is that marketing spin, gut health?
Felice will be best placed to answer that one, but I'd say so. But it is a really important term, I think. So when I use it, I would understand it to mean, you know, relating to dietary health and any treatment that can impact the gut. I mean, the gut is the interface organ between sort of any medication we have, any foods that we eat, and the body. You know, the intestinal tract is very long. From my point of view as a psychiatrist, you've mentioned the term second brain. It's highly innovated. It's got its own nervous system in the gut. So the things that we put in our gut can have a big impact on the gut nervous system and the brain.
And how individual it is. Here's just one of the texts, and it says, Rish, my friend's son, who is autistic, has for the last 3 years been living totally on a diet of pizza. Absolutely nothing else. He won't eat anything else. He's just spent 6 weeks in hospital while they try and repair his bowel and other kind of internal organs. And when we talk about mental health and individual reasons, and we know that people potentially on the spectrum who might only eat certain types of food or one types of food, there will be parents out there that would be racking their brains and thinking, okay, I know all you're going to eat is pizza, but at least you're eating something. When we talk about where the research is heading, where does something like maybe other conditions come into this?
I think this is a really good point around autism spectrum disorder, and something that's strongly associated with the condition is that there do tend to be sensory preferences, strong sensory preferences. So, dietary deficiencies and issues around dietary health can be a big problem with individuals on the spectrum, and even certain eating disorders are more commonly seen comorbid with autism spectrum disorder. There's one called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, ARFID, as we call it, that we commonly see and that I commonly work with in my clinical role, working in functional gut disorders. So it's an important issue.
Kim's called us from Reservoir.
I was on the same. My grandmother lived to about 96 and had about 2 years of dementia. And her sister, my great-auntie, lived to 101. And my grandmother always eating plenty of greens, cooking her own dinner.
Oh, Kim, we don't have the best line with you there, but I think I know what you're saying, which is your nan had a really good diet. And when we think about what our grandparents ate, even our parents, it's pretty true. I don't think there was any junk food in my nan and pa's house. Although, when the first KFC opened up in Maui, they were pretty excited, I have to say. But other than that, they were really healthy.
Yeah, my mum was born in 1920, and it said that was the healthiest generation because they tended to have access to nutritious food, but it was before ultra-processed foods became a thing. And people would cook at home, and even if it was just, the typical meat and three veg, it was generally whole food that hadn't been interfered with. And that my mum similarly lived till 98, and that's a very common story. But now in the US, This is the first time the generation alive today is expected to have a shorter lifespan than that of their parents, primarily due to chronic disease that is driven by diet.
What upsets me in this conversation is, again, this is not putting the blame onto anyone, because in a lot of ways we're busier than we've ever been before. You don't have a mum most of the time now staying at home and being able to cook and to shop and to do all of those things. But the labelling and the image that we are sold is actually health washing us. We are told this is quick and easy and this is the solution for you and for your family. The labelling around ultra-processed food, something has to change there, surely.
Yeah, I think this is what Dr. Wolfgang Marx was mentioning before in terms of the novelty of the concept of ultra-processed food, is that, you know, our food systems have typically been focused on nutrients and they will always be important, but the idea that you can label something as healthy based purely on these nutrients is it's not enough. And the research that's coming out is that there are other aspects of industrial processing that can impact our health. And so in terms of labelling food products, absolutely, we need to...
We don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, even the heart tick, I remember when a fillet of fish was given that. So then you start to question, well, what does any of this mean if I can go into a fast food chain and it's been given a tick of approval?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of historically one of the sort of the tricky things with, I guess, the ultra-processed food sort of system is where, you know, we said, oh, well, we see that fat might be bad for you, so then there's this rise of low-fat products that are, you know, high in sugar, and then, oh, well, we don't want to eat sugar anymore, so now it's high in artificial sweeteners, and we sort of keep moving to these other that we think are fixes, but really we just kind of need to go back to that generation before where we have this more...
I don't know whether you can get the genie back in the bottle.
It's a very, very good question, and it's one that, you know, is great concern to health, public health professionals and policymakers right around the world. We know that our global food system, our global industrialised food system, at a very bare minimum, these are UN Food Summit report costs, cost the globe $20 trillion a year. Now, just to put that into context, the whole GDP of China is about $16 trillion a year. Now, that costing has come from very minimal information. It doesn't take into account a whole host of other costs that really could be included in that. But of that $20 trillion, about $11 trillion is the cost to human health, because poor diet and its consequences are in the top five causes of illness and early death across the globe. About $7 trillion is the cost to the environment, because our industrialised food system, with land clearing and monocropping and pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, antibiotics, it's the leading cause of biodiversity loss. And biodiversity loss in the environment links to biodiversity loss in humans, which is our microbiome. And here we're seeing this massive increase in things that are linked to our microbiome and our immune system, because about 70% of our immune cells are actually in the gut. Things like asthma and eczema, but autoimmune diseases too, rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 diabetes, these types of illnesses are massively increasing. And then, of course, you've got the neurodevelopmental disorders, which many people think are linked to the microbiome.
So how wide do you make this lens when we start to talk about preventative health? Again, another term that we're only starting to take seriously now and put some serious investment into, because if we start to look at the big picture, we're going to keep people out of hospitals, we're going to keep people needing sort of really intense treatment as they age. But we've got to start to look at everything then, from
it's
how we treat our
elephant.
Farmers to the to the role that supermarkets have. Yeah.
It's the
to
elephant
canteens.
In the room. It's like the major cost to us as a planet of humans. It's the major cause of illness and early death. It's a major cost to our public health system and all of the things that come from that. And yet there's nothing, not a single bit of food policy that aims to limit the behaviours, the marketing, the availability, the pricing of these ultra-processed foods in the environment. And lobbying, of course, plays a very large role in this. If you think globally, the industrialised food system and its players are probably the largest companies in the world and very, very powerful.
So there's been a huge spotlight on supermarkets of late. What role do supermarkets play here in falsely promoting certain foods to us, or maybe making us potentially buy things that we don't need and that we don't want and that aren't healthy for us? Could they play a better role, and do they have more significance in this conversation?
I don't know so much about supermarkets. My sort of background is that bigger food systems lens, but just from personal experience and going shopping with a three-year-old daughter.
Oh, no, that's hell.
Going down the chocolate aisle, or even trying just to go through the checkout and seeing things that are at her head height, that are there, their product placements, they're there particularly, you know, to target that sort of audience. And it's difficult. It's really horrible.
And the story we've been sold forever. I had this light bulb moment when having a very similar conversation on this very program not too long ago about cereal, because cereal is one of the main offenders here. It's a breakfast food. But this professor said to me, she said, we were sold a very long time ago that breakfast has to be fun. Breakfast doesn't have to be fun, right? But for whatever reason, kids think it has to be fun. Parents feel like they're failing if their kids aren't having fun at breakfast, that they're just having some kind of nutritionist meal that's going to set them up for the day, right? But this story's been going on since the beginning of Cocoa Pops. Like, how do we rewrite that?
Yeah, so I think this speaks to the larger point around accessibility and marketing of these products. So when I originally talked about addressing the larger food system, yes, it's about access to healthy, nutritious foods, but it's also about our messaging and our restriction of messaging, particularly to our vulnerable population, i.e. our children, in terms of the advertisements, the colourful packaging, the aisles with the head height, ultra processed food, all those sorts of things, I think is fairly low hanging fruit, pun intended, strategies to try and sort of reduce this accessibility problem.
Marketing restrictions for sure, and getting, you know, cartoon characters off of the front of labels to entice kids, because they absolutely pick up those sorts of things.
Well, you know,
they're intrigued. In places like South America, they have started to implement really strong marketing restrictions, and, you know, they've got big front of packet warning labels, so black hexagon shapes with, you know, it'll say if it's high in calorie, high in salt, high in sugar and fat, but also restrictions on these types of cartoon characters have been taken off. And you compare that to what we have here in Australia or the UK or the US, and, you know, very different scenario. So they're really leading the charge, the South Americans.
Yeah, I remember seeing a picture online where they took a photo of the international aisle in, it was some South American company, and they had all the cereals that we imported from America, but they had to have essentially masking tape on the...
Like cigarettes.
Yeah, essentially to block out, because
it's
that's
exactly
against,
right. That's why
the
there's often parallels drawn between tobacco and, you know, the restrictions that have worked in that field, and applying that to ultra-processed foods.
You're on the Conversation Hour. Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt. We are live today from the waterfront here at Deakin. We are right down on the main road. We're talking about food and mood. With you, Professor Felice Jacko, who is the director of the Food and Mood Centre, Dr. Melissa Lane, Dr. Wolfgang Marx, and also Dr. Jessica Green. When we talk about the ways we treat anxiety and depression, how much of a role and how careful do we have to be with diet? Because the last thing you want is someone self-diagnosing and thinking, that's great, I can come off my meds and I'm just going to eat leafy greens and everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, as we often say, you know, you don't cure depression with a salad. It's not that simple. Very, very complex disorder, very serious disorder for major depressive disorder. All the research that's been done in this area, there's been several clinical trials now, and including our SMILES trial, the dietary support was given alongside other forms of treatment. So people were mainly on either antidepressants, psychotherapy, or both. This wasn't an either or, and we always say this very, very clearly. This is not one or the other. In the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatry guidelines, it's put as a foundation of treatment, but then other treatments can go on top of that as needed. But basically the idea is that it's a platform. It's the foundation, because if you get that right, all sorts of other treatments are going to work better. Now, if we think about all of those factors that are involved in mental and brain health, the immune system, mitochondria, all these types of things, and know that diet is affecting all of those things, and probably, although this is a guess at this point, but probably largely through the gut microbiome, that gives people a really strong incentive to change. But what we also say is it doesn't need to be perfect. Mm. You don't need to get really hung up on the details. As long as most of your diet is coming from whole foods, doesn't mean that you have to be a vegan, doesn't mean that you have to eat everything organic, doesn't mean that you can never have a treat or an ice cream or anything like that. It just means that you're trying to get those fundamentals right, which is a wide variety, diversity of plant foods, and, you know, healthier fats and oils, and trying to avoid those ultra-processed foods.
Jess, as a psychiatrist, did you ever think in your field of work and when you were speaking with patients and with clients that you'd be talking about their diet? Because, I mean, 20 years ago, you probably never would have spoken about that.
I think it makes sense to me that what we eat has an impact. I feel like this is something when I deliver this message to individuals that I work work with, it makes sense to them. I don't have to do a sort of hard sell on diet. And I think that's the great thing about this, I would say emerged area of nutritional psychiatry, is it's what people want, and it gives them other options than just the traditional medications and psychotherapy, which are great, but, you know, like Professor Jack was saying, depression is very complex. It's multifactorial. And the more of the factors that we can treat in working with people with depression, the more likely they are to have a good response. So that's what I say to the clients that I work with. You know, the more things we can do, the more likely you are to recover.
Plenty of texts on this. Lots of people referring back to their nans and to their grandparents who lived to be over 100 and always ate really healthy. And lots of people asking for tighter regulation and wanting to be able to understand labelling. We'll get to that in just a moment as well. You're on The Conversation Hour. We are live today from our pop-up studio down at Geelong.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Here on The Conversation Hour, we're looking at the connection between the food that we eat and our mood. Lots of people asking for Bluey branding to come off all of those ultra-processed packages and foods. Dr. Sandro DiMeo from Vic Health does a lot of work on this program, and we've spoken at length about two things. And one is, why is it that you can't have a pharmacist within X amount of Ks of each other, yet you can have four junk food shops and takeaway outlets wherever they want to be? But the other thing that we both bang on a lot about is the role that schools and government can potentially play in us having a better diet. And I know that Ali Moore does What If Wednesdays, but what if, right, we were able to give every child in state school a free lunch, a free meal, and a healthy meal? Okay, we've got arms pumping, right. Sandro believes hand on heart that that is possible, yeah, and it will change people's lives.
Yeah. I could not agree more. It's something that we're really just starting a major program of research from next week that includes a whole lot of real experts at Deakin, including Professor Anna Peters, who really understands about food systems in our area. And my particular interest is around biodiversity and how we grow our food and the potential for regenerative farming to increase our biodiversity. So in our region, we're lucky enough to have the very first Farm My School project. Now, this was, you know, people from the ABC were involved in this, Costa, when it was first put together.
Yeah, if you want something done right, get Costa involved.
Yeah, exactly. So at our Ballarine Secondary College, they had this huge unused soccer pitch. And so they said, right, let's turn this into a regenerative farm. So a regen farm doesn't just avoid pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, etc., but it basically really nurtures the soil. It doesn't overcrop it. It rotates crops. It does a no-tilling method. And all of this is designed to get the microbes in the soil doing what they do best, which is getting nutrients into the food and also producing food that has a very high phytochemical content. So this is one of the aspects of ultra-processed foods that we think is really critical. It's not just about food that might have, vitamins, minerals added to it. Even foods with a supposedly nutritionally balanced profile that are ultra-processed, we think that they're going to have different impacts on the body. And we've just finished a study of this where we do see very different impacts on the microbiome, even though the foods are supposedly nutritionally similar and balanced. But in plant foods, in real foods, we might have as many as 150,000 different types of phytochemicals that interact with each other and with the body in really complex ways, and we're only just beginning to even think about that. So with regeneratively farmed vegetables and foods, you're getting more of those microbes, you're getting more of those nutrients, those phytochemicals. And the Farm My School project down at Ballarine Secondary College is now producing food for the for the local communities. So it's addressing food insecurity. It's training kids in farming and regen farming techniques. What we would like to see is this scaled up across Victoria so that every public school and even things like youth justice centres and things where they've got land is producing regeneratively farmed food. That food is going to the schools for school lunch programs where kids can prepare the foods, they can be exposed to these foods and all the nutrients and microbes that come with it, but also even things like Barwon Health, our hospitals, where patients who need support to heal can get these foods.
How possible do you think it would be to feed children healthily and free? And what sort of impact do you think that would have from behavioural issues? So we talk about classrooms now and the added pressure that is put onto teachers to deal with everything from ADHD to all sorts of behavioural issues that young people may have. And then the connection to the food that they're eating. Canteens are often outsourced and run as small businesses and profit now as well. So the impetus to necessarily serve healthy food isn't first and foremost. Profit is. How do we change that?
Yeah, look, I think we're talking about this as if it's this novel, this thing that's never been done. But really, Australia is kind of a standout compared to many other countries or comparable economic circumstance that do have these programs. You know, we just had collaborators from Japan come over and they talked about their free lunch programs for their schools. And it's a thing that's been happening forever. So I think it shows that it can be done. We just need to,
although it shouldn't be pizza and nuggets, which is the sort of thing that you might get in the UK, the US. That has been traditionally the case, which it could be doing more harm than good.
Or a Dorito chip that's like nutritionally perfect, you know, on the packet, but it's actually a Dorito chip.
But so how does that happen, right? How does that happen?
Every country and region has their own different regulations, and that's part of the issue, I would say. But up until now, I think marketing regulations in Australia have been voluntary. That's, you know, another issue. We just can't keep working like that. We really need the leadership from governments. And
David's in Port Melbourne. Morning, David.
You?
Hey, what did you want to say?
Oh, look, there's some simple stuff to do. I know these massive ultra-processed food guys are very, very strong. But one of the ways that I've found it easy to watch what I eat is simply don't go down the sections that have chocolate and snacks. Now, if the government were to say, okay, let's give supermarkets two, three aisles, or however many they might regulate, but they've got to keep the ultra food in those aisles and also ban them at the end. We know that they're so cheap, they can knock them down to half price. Don't put them on the ends of the aisles.
Yeah. And then there's another bugbear of mine, which is the twofer.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh. The deals. They're always at the end of the supermarket.
Because the fact is, sometimes you want a packet of chips. So this is not less. People are saying, but I like to have my chocolate occasionally. So we're not saying, who doesn't want a packet of salt and vinegar chips on a Friday night after work? That is mandatory in our household. Mm-hmm. But when I go to buy the chips, I don't want to feel like an idiot if I don't buy two packets because one packet is as expensive as two.
Yeah. So when and then it's in the house and of course you're going to eat.
Of course it's going to get eaten. So when we talk about regulation, there's regulation and then there's regulation, Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you tackle that. I think that comes down to the difference between, you know, supermarkets and what they do at their level, which we know that they, you know, they have product placement. They're put in particular spots at particular times with these deals to get people to buy them. So you would want, you know, some kind of regulation around that. But we also need that top tier.
And the other thing is the health star rating.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, there is not a single nutrition or public health person in Australia who would endorse our current health star rating. You could get an ice cream, you could pick it up and it would have 4 stars. And you go, oh, that means it's a healthy product.
And my daughter tries to convince me with things like that all the time. Yeah. Look, Mum.
It's not healthy. It's saying is that compared to other ice creams, it's a bit more healthy. Mm. It's compared like to like.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's a voluntary system as well. Is that right?
As far as I understand,
the Health Star rating is a voluntary system. So it's not, you know, if you're producing these types of food, you don't necessarily need to put that on your label. And that's, you know, the issue. If you can put it on your label and your product is an ice cream, then you're using that nutrient focus to market your foods.
So is that the first thing we could change? If we had the power, would that be one of the more significant, that it wasn't opt-in, it wasn't voluntary, it was mandatory?
Well, yes, but it needs to change, because at the moment a 4-star rating doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean it's intrinsically healthy. It just means that it's healthier than another sort of product
based
on nutrients alone, not considering the processing. So I think the first thing is marketing. So I think that should not be a voluntary thing. That should be regulated.
So this is where I get so upset, right? Because when we talk about preventative health and we talk about what's being marketed to people, because fundamentally everybody is trying to do the right thing either for themselves or for their family. Mm. No one is going out and trying to make their child depressed or have diabetes. It's just not what they're doing. Mm. But if you are being sold something that says, this is healthy, this is sugar-free, this has got X amount of stars, this has got a tick, then...
Yeah, what hope do people have? Mm. And it's deliberately designed to confuse, I believe, because it's all about the profit motive.
In Japan, says this text, primary schools, secondary schools, up to year 9, they provide lunch and most of them have dietitians as well. Also, many primary schools have veggie gardens and in certain grades they use it to crop the veggies. We have a cooking class probably from grade 5 and grade 6. We learn how to cook. Yes, our life expectancy as Japanese is the longest in the world. Mm. That's from Aki in Werribee. One thing that we haven't touched on is looking into some of the different ways that we really treat our gut health and we find different ways to help us with different diseases that we may have is looking at fecal transplants. Now, the first time I spoke about, which is a poo transplant, by the way, let's just face facts. This is something, Jess, that you are doing your PhD in here at Deakin. How far have we come in getting over the ick factor of it and understanding, you know, what it really is and what you do have to potentially keep in your freezer if this is what you're doing?
The ick factor. Yeah, I like that. That's what my at the clinical trial that we ran called the Moving Mood Study, which was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study of enema-delivered fecal transplants, poo transplants, compared to a fake poo transplant, just basically brown dyed salty water.
A sentence I never thought I would hear spoken on this program, but so happy that it is.
That's what we established in this in our study, is that people with depression do accept it, and that was one of the primary outcomes that we were looking at, was feasibility. So in terms of ick factor, people were very open to this, and that it's already, I guess, poo transplants are already around. They've been a lot.
How do they help? So who would come to you? What kind of conditions, you know, what kind of pain would they be in? What sort of solutions would they be looking for?
Well, in terms of the poo transplants have been around for ages, and they're used as a mainstream treatment for a gut infection called Clostridium difficile. So that's probably worth being aware of, that they're already out there widely used, where they're a life-saving treatment. To the question of what would I use them for in depression? Well, their effectiveness in depression is not yet established, and that's what our research has been about. Like, there's quite exciting studies in mice showing that when you put poo from a depressed human into a mouse, it brings on the mouse version of depression, which is crazy. and that's been reproduced a number of times. Same for schizophrenia. You take schizophrenia from a human with schizophrenia, put it into a mouse, and the mouse develops a mouse version of schizophrenia.
And there's also several very, very compelling case studies that have been published in Australia people with long-standing, very severe bipolar disorder who've treated themselves with an FMT and experienced a very profound recovery. This has been written up, but of course there's really, really big health risks with doing it yourself. I mean, there's all sorts of things that can be transmitted with poo. So we're working with Lifeblood, so the National Blood Bank you'd know of. They've also got a national stool bank now. And that stool bank has been set up primarily to provide very heavily screened, very, very safe poo for use for with C. difficile. But we're now talking to the state government about getting funding to scale this up because we want to do the first randomised control trial of poo transplants for major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder. And colleagues at St Vincent's, Professor Michael Cam, want to do it in inflammatory bowel disease, and Professor Alex Bousiatis wants to do it in cancer. Now, FMT is being trialled in cancer, and it's particularly interesting that this whole new field of immunotherapy in cancer, which is offering so much promise for the first time in cancer treatment and outcomes, it looks like the gut and its diversity, which is a marker of a healthy gut, seem to play a very important role in predicting who responds to immunotherapy in particular. And they're doing pilot studies where they're taking poo from people who have responded to immunotherapy and putting it into people who haven't responded. So there's this whole area where we think we could potentially have life-saving, transformative treatments if we can do the science that shows and demonstrates the efficacy of these treatments.
This coming Wednesday, our topic on the Conversation Hour is clinical trials and access to clinical trials and how easy or simple that is or isn't, especially depending on where you live, if you're in regional Victoria. So I might be picking your brain when we come off air to get some of those numbers to include that in our program on Wednesday.
When we advertise for our Moving Mood study, and we only needed 15 people because it was a pilot trial. We had more than 160 people on the waiting list within just a couple of weeks. And people
were
willing.
Australia.
They were coming. They said, we'd come from interstate. We'd camp out. We'd just do whatever we need to do to get access to treatment because major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, many of the mental disorders, they're chronic, serious conditions that completely debilitate people and stop them from experiencing the joys of life and being able to work and all of those things. And our treatments currently really only help a small proportion of people.
If we bring that back to, I guess, a more basic level for those of us who are getting through life that don't have any clinical issues, that don't have a mental health condition, but if we're not eating a great diet, would the two of you, and just finally as we draw to a close, do you think that it just makes us feel a bit sad? Like, can it have an impact if we aren't eating enough fresh fruit and vegetables for whatever reason, if we're eating what is ultra-processed food and we might think we're doing the right thing because it tells us we're doing the right thing, can it make us feel depressed?
Look, I think it's an important take-home message. It's not so much about the stuff that we're not eating, it's the stuff that we're also eating. So I guess to explain that, we now have good evidence to show that a high consumption of ultra-processed foods is associated with increased risk of low mood, depressive symptoms, these sorts of things. But it's also about the foods that you add in, those minimally processed foods, and they have a substantial, I think it's a 30% reduced risk if you have adherence to, say, a Mediterranean-style diet. It's about 30% reduced risk of those depressive symptoms. So I think it's less about just focusing on what you need to cut out, but also the types of foods that you need to add in. So those unprocessed fruits, vegetables, beans, spices, all these sorts of things, I think is an important message there.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, I think as a take home, focusing on what we can add into our diets, which is the minimally processed, unprocessed, tinned, fresh, frozen fruits and vegetables and beans and legumes. I think that would be a simple message.
I don't know where I'd be without tinned chickpeas and
pantry staples.
They are a lifesaver.
Tinned tomatoes. Yeah. Use them in everything.
Are you confident you're being listened to? I mean, you're all doing incredible research. Mm-hmm. Are you being listened to?
You know what? The federal government is really listening. So Minister Emma McBride, who's the Assistant Mental Health Minister, she's super interested. We've had many conversations with her. We're really, really hoping that a lot of our new research just supports a completely new way of looking and treating these disorders. We're now running the very large Harmony trial, which is a national trial that looks at whether diet and exercise support is at least as effective as psychology support from a clinical psychologist. That's been run right around the country. Wow. People who are living with major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, they can go and be assessed to see if they're eligible for this trial. And if they get in, they get 8 weeks of free treatment from either clinical psychologists or lifestyle support from dietitians, exercise physiologists. That's right across the country. It's delivered via telehealth, so you don't need to go anywhere. You can do it from home. And that is a really important opportunity, I think, for people, because we already have pilot data to suggest that that's a really beneficial way of addressing this.
How can people get involved?
So there's the main way would be to actually look, send an email to Harmony, so H-A-R-M-O-N-E, at deakin.edu.au, or the phone number is 03-5227-2380, so 03-5227-2380, or they can go to our Food and Mood Centre website. And
so the
there.
Food and Mood, throw Food and Mood Deakin into your search engine,
yeah,
and you may be able to be a part of that trial. It's incredible, groundbreaking, world-leading work that you do, and it's needed, and I really hope that you are being listened to and some of those changes occur. Professor Felice Jacka, Director of the Food Mood Centre here at Deakin, thank you so much. Dr. Jess Green, psychiatrist and PhD Deakin, a student here at Deakin as well. Dr. Melissa Lane and Dr. Wolfgang Marx, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
No, thanks for having us. It's been wonderful down here. I'll be back with you tomorrow. But don't forget, the Conversation Hour is also a podcast. So if you've missed today's show or you want to share it with someone, the best thing to do is to subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast. Go to the ABC Listen app. We've done entire programs on everything from where we build and how that impacts our health to entire programs on fecal transplants, even on cereal and why cereal shouldn't actually be classified a breakfast food. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Tomorrow we're looking at where we build and why that's important as well. But take care, and I'll speak to you tomorrow.